بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Did I say that Martin Luther King married a man a second wife? I mean Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther King. Today we have the final lecture about Omar ibn al-Khattab. It will be divided into four parts. The one is the administration of Omar ibn al-Khattab. The second is what happened on the Eastern Front, the Persian Empire. And the third part will be what happened on the Western Front with the Roman Empire, and then the end of the person of Omar ibn Khattab. Main features of the administration of Omar is he laid the foundation to the concept of opposition. And this was manifest when he was making a speech, and he was preaching against paying high dowries on marriage, until a woman stood up and said, "Omar, you are not in a position to say that, because this conflicts with the Quran," and she quoted the Quran, and he said, "The woman is right and I am wrong." So again, this was the beginning of political opposition, and as a matter of fact, women participating in that opposition. Again, he would declare, "Whoever see me deviating, you have to correct me." And the man said, "By God, Omar, if we see you deviating, we'll correct you even by the edge of our swords." And Omar said, "God bless you as long as you say it, and bless us as long as we hear it." Omar, and I think there is a bit confusion about that. I once got the copy of a speech made by a Muslim woman. And when she mentioned Omar al-Khattab, she said he oppressed women, etc., etc. Whereas history speaks against that. Omar was the first to appoint a woman judge. When he appointed the woman called al-Shafa' to be judge over the commercial law, the market, and etc. Whether Omar was harsh to women, etc., a man once went to the house of Omar ibn al-Khattab. And he knocked at the door, and then Omar didn't come promptly, during which the man heard Omar's wife shouting and yelling at him. Some wives do. And when Omar opened the door, he found the man going away, and he called him, "Why are you going away?" And the man told him, "I have come to complain to you about my wife who shouts at me." And then when I heard your wife shouting at you, I said, "Well, this is not the man to complain to." Omar was very considerate about women. He once found a man who was a bit tuggy. Tuggy is the word. He was not looking his best. And he told him, "How come you do that? Are you not married?" He said, "Yes, I am." And he told them, "It is the right of your wife that you beautify yourself to her as it is her right to beautify herself to you." Omar was the first to establish the Hijri calendar. Of course, before the Hijra, the same lunar months were known to the Arabs, but the annual calendar, he took it as beginning from the year of the Hijra of the Prophet ﷺ, realizing that this was really the beginning of Islam as a state, and that the Hijra was the sudden change of Islam from an oppressed ideology to be a full-blown state with the government and the constitution and laws, etc. And this is the history, the calendar we are following until now. Umar started a civil service that was called the Diwan, and he quoted it from the happenings in the Roman Empire. Umar didn't say this is the Kafir system, it is not Islamic, etc. But very promptly he found it was for the welfare of the state, and he introduced it into the Muslim state. This is amazing because this was the time of Umar 1400 years ago. Nowadays you find the Muslims still debating whether to go democracy or not, because democracy is a Kafir system and we shouldn't join, etc. Alhamdulillah, Umar was wiser and he took the systems in the open lands whenever he felt they were for the welfare of the people. He was the first to found the Baytul Mal, the treasury. There was no treasury before, and he established the treasury as well as the general census, something like the social security number. Now, every person in the Muslim Empire was registered, and when new ones were born, they would be registered, because it was the right to take some money from the government, especially the poor, and therefore he had to have a full count of the people in the empire and the registering the new births and deaths, etc., and that he was the first to establish. He was the first to separate the judiciary from the executive branches of the government. Before that, the caliph used to be the judge. People would go to him, etc. But Umar separated the judiciary system. The judges were appointed as judges. And on a few occasions, the caliph was accused of something, and he would send the complainer and the caliph to the judge to make them sit down before them without any favor being done to the caliph. And often the verdict went against the caliph. He was the first to give salaries, especially to the armed forces, and the first to have armed forces. Before that, when there was battle, people just volunteered and everyone was responsible for his own horse, his own armory and the weapons, etc. But Umar established the concept of a full-time civil servant or a full-time military servant in lieu of a constant salary. He was the first to establish a prison. Before that, there were no prisons, but seeing that now the population has grown and not all people were that concentrated in their faith as in previous times, and many people came into Islam with dilute faith, and it seemed that there was necessity to establish a prison. He was the first to arrange a mail service across the empire. It wasn't, of course, aeroplanes. It was stage coaches, maybe. It was horses with several resting places along the road. But he connected all the empire by this mail service. He was the first to coin Islamic money. Before the time, Muslims used to deal in Persian money, but Umar built a factory especially to mint, to produce Islamic money. before Umar, when the Muslim army went into a land, then whatever they conquered will be 20% to the central budget, and the rest would be divided between the soldiers, the fighting people. Umar stopped this, and this was also a novelty at the time of Umar, because it was according to the Quran and what happened during the time of the Prophet and during the time of Abu Bakr. But Umar stopped this, and he was wise enough to see that if I started dividing the land between armies, there will be no land for the future generations, for the populace. And he found that the people, the owners of the land, the farmers, would be much better off cultivating their own lands. And in lieu of this leaving the land in their hand, they would pay a tax over whatever the land produced. So it was the produce that was counted, and they paid for that. He decreed that the Sahaba, especially the senior Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet, would not be allowed outside Medina. Very strange. The empire grew. There was the Persian side and the Roman side. Everybody went there. Everybody became rich. But the Sahaba, you stay here. I'm not going to subject you to the fitna of becoming rich. I need you to give me counsel. And he established the rule of counsel. These were his parliament, the senior Sahaba present in Medina, and he wouldn't allow them to go. And even whenever a man came to him, I want to go to join the army, I want to do jihad, he would say, well, it's enough for you that you did jihad with the Prophet, and now you stay in. Umar was very reputed for consulting the young people. And whenever there was an issue for debate or consultation, Umar made the point of inviting a group of young people. And when I say young, it is young, because you remember that the commander-in-chief of the army of the Prophet was 17 years old. At the time, he wasn't considered a child. But even younger people, Umar invited to take their opinion in things. He was very keen and scrupulous in choosing the rulers and the governors he would send to the various states along the empire. One of his beautiful descriptions of a suitable ruler is, he said, if he is with the people, he wouldn't notice he is the chief. And if he is with another people, different people, alien people, you would think he was their chief. And this kind of personality, that to be humble amongst your people under your authority, and to look very distinct when you are with other people, was one of his measures for a suitable ruler. He used to keep track of his rulers, not by spying, but by sending people to see the news in the different parts of the empire. And he would say, suppose I choose to you someone who is just and the taqi, has taqwa, etc., would you be pleased? And everyone would say yes. He said, no, this is not enough. They have to have taqwa, they have to be able, they have to be honest, and I have to send the people to check over that. And this Umar used very extensively. You know that when Sa'd ibn Abu Waqqas later built his palace, he sent someone and burnt the gate of the palace so that there will be no barrier between people and going in. the time of Umar, the two cities of Kufa and the Basra were built, and amazingly enough, it was the planning, was his planning, build a mosque in the center and then leave a space of so much arm length and make a circle of streets, the width should be so much, etc., etc. In Egypt, he ordered the digging of a canal, which is, as a matter of fact, the precursor, not of the Suez Canal, but it was between the Nile and the Red Sea. And they used to call it the canal of the Amir al-Mu'mineen, of the faithful. Until my early youth, there was a street in Cairo called Shara al-Khalij, the street of the canal. And the name, it was named after that canal, the canal that Umar ibn al-Khattab ordered dug from the Nile to the Sinai. It is now no more, it disappeared, even the name has changed. Then I would like to touch on the conquests, the wars at the time of Umar. And the beginning is the Eastern Front with the Persian Empire. I will not bother you with maps and names, etc. But you know that already at the time of Abu Bakr there was the skirmishes between the Persian Empire and the Muslim armies. A leader here by the name of Al-Muthanna used to have the skirmishes, and when he found that there was almost no response, they just fly away and that's that, he advised Abu Bakr of pursuing the Persians, because if he leaves it to them, they will always recoup and re-attack the Muslims again. And Al-Muthanna sent a message to the Persian leader inviting him to Islam or to pay the tax or to fight. And the Persian leader sent him a letter despising him, saying, "I am sending you an army of pig shepherds and poultry raisers," as if the Muslims were that not good enough to get a proper army. And Muthanna answered him, "It seems that this is all what has been left for you to fight with." And Muthanna took ill, and Umar appointed a very famous leader, a name worth remembering, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas. And the Sa'd led a series of battles. I'm not going to follow them one by one, but the advice of Umar was to fight at Qadisiyah. This is Qadisiyah, a very famous name in Islamic history. You see it now? The thick circle, the very thick circle in the lower part. And it was a great battle, because before the battle, Sa'd sent word to Khusro, and Khusro invited Sa'd to send an emissary. And several days, a new emissary would go upon the request of Qaisar, of Khusro, and they would explain Islam to him. But at the end, he insulted them and sent the emissaries back, heaping dust over them. This was a method of humiliating people, just to heap dust over them. And when they came back to Sa'd, he said, "Alhamdulillah, the man is giving us his land." He took the good omen from that. And Sa'd made the great conquest at Qadisiyah. And according to the advice of Omar, Sa'd continued to Al-Madain. And this was the last battle really. Kisra was at Al-Madain, and Sa'd went and had a battle there. The Persians had the novelty of using elephants in their army, and the elephants frightened the horses of the Muslims, and this was the long experience. And the Sa'd advised people to go and cut the above every elephant was a box like thing, a shelter with people inside who would throw the archers. And he advised people to cut the belts tying the boxes to the elephants. And also they dressed the horses of the Muslims in a special way with a black dress. And this gave a counter effect, because the clothed horses and the camels of the Muslims frightened the horses of the Persians, and they flew away. And then Sa'd went to Al-Madain, took it. And that was when he decided to stay here, to live here. And for the first time, he would pray the prayer of the non-traveler. No qasr, instead of the dhuhr two rakahs and the asr two rakahs, he would do the full prayer of a resident here. And he fasted Ramadan, and he ordered the building of his palace there. Funnily enough, he called it the White Palace, or the White House. Many battles, but it ended up with the Muslims on this front occupying the land, which is from the east side was limited by the Sindh province in India and the river of Gaihun. To the west, the rivers of Iraq and the Persian Gulf. South, it would be the Indian Ocean, and above to the north until Armenia. This is the we can do without this. The Eastern Front. On the Western Front, there were two main events. The completion of the opening of all Syria, and I already told you that Abu Bakr had sent several leaders there. And Syria was taken except for Jerusalem, Al-Quds, that was circled by the Muslims because Omar didn't really want to make battle inside a holy place, Masjid Al-Aqsa. But the circle was so complete that the inhabitants inside started to suffer. And the Roman garrison inside the city lost hope and lost face with the people, so that one of the locals took over, and he was the bishop there. He was a bishop called Sophronius, and he sent word that yes, we are willing to surrender Jerusalem, but to none else than Omar himself. Upon which Omar took the journey, and accompanying only one companion, and they approached Jerusalem, and the people were looking for the army and the imperial guard or presidential guard. They said only two people coming, and Omar went, and the Christians of the land welcomed him so much. Sophronius took him to visit the church, the Holy Sepulchre, and while inside the church, Omar wanted to pray an Asr prayer, and the bishop said, well, you can pray here, but Omar said, no, I'll not pray here lest Muslims who will come after me would think it is all right for them to go inside and make their prayers. And he went outside the church and made his prayers. Then a very interesting treaty was given by Omar to them. It is called Ahd Omar, the pledge, the treaty of Omar. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is the pledge given by Amir al-Mu'mineen, Omar, to the people of Jerusalem, that they are safe for their lives, for their positions, for their churches, for their crosses, for their money. And that whoever wants to leave with the Romans would leave with the Romans, taking whatever they like from their positions. And that the Romans would just withdraw and go out in peace. And the Christians requested Omar to put in the terms of the treaty that no Jews would dwell in Jerusalem with them. As a matter of fact, their request, no Jews would come into Jerusalem, but Omar insisted that the freedom of worship should be there and they should come to pray, but on condition they'll not actually live in the city as residents. You see how things have changed. On another occasion, Omar wanted to revisit Palestine, and on his way up there was the plague in the city called Amwas, and so he said to his companions, let us go back. And one of the enthusiasts told him, are you fleeing the qada of Allah? Are you fleeing the predestiny that Allah ordained upon us? And Omar's wise answer said, I am fleeing the qada of Allah to the qada of Allah. That if going is from the qada, being wise and returning is also from the qada of Allah, because Allah wants us to use our minds. On the Egyptian front, the army went under the leadership of Omar ibn al-Khattab and of Amr ibn al-As. And that army was 4,000 people. And some very interesting points. Omar always abhorred water separating him from his armies. And so when the Muslim army proceeded and was approaching the borders of Egypt, Omar sent a quick urgent messenger to Amr ibn al-As with a letter ordering him to come back. Amr ibn al-As was a very crafty person, as we'll see later, and so he guessed what was in the letter. So he received the emissary of the caliph, treated him very nicely, kept his good company, told him stories until they were inside the borders of Egypt, and then opened the letter. And the letter was, if you are yet to reach Egypt, come back. If you have already gone to Egypt, then continue. And so it was Amr's intelligence and firasa. Interestingly, the daughter of the ruler of Egypt, it is an interesting story that I once said it in one of the khutbas on Friday, was very frightened, and she had a maid called Armanosa, and she said, oh Armanosa, those savage Arabs coming from the desert, what are they going to do to us except the worst of the worst? But Armanosa said, my lady, you are mistaken. Those people travel each with his mosque inside his heart. and they do not raise the sword except by a law, and they do not put down the sword except by a law, and they carry an ideology, and their prophet taught them. And I assure you, my lady, that the girl, and they do not put down the sword except by a law, and they carry an ideology, and their prophet taught them. And I assure you, my lady, that the girl from us should feel safer under one of those than she is in the company of her own father. So that was already the reputation of the Muslims, and that reputation led to the people helping the Muslim army. At that time, Egypt was Christian. Egypt was under the rule of Rome, but their sects were different. The Egyptians endorsed one form of Christianity, and the Romans endorsed another form, and there was severe oppression on the Egyptians to coerce them into following the sect of the Roman Empire. So much so that the Egyptian bishop already fled to the western desert, fleeing the oppression of the Romans. So an army coming with that reputation, and the reputation of never forcing people to change their faith, at the same time under oppression, yes, of fellow Christians, but it was oppression leading to the flight of their bishop. And so the Egyptians helped the Muslim army, and the first thing the Muslim army did was calling back Bishop Benjamin, reinstating him as the Pope of the Copts in Egypt, and giving them the full freedom to pursue their own faith, which they did. And it was almost 7 years until the Egyptians began accepting Islam in large numbers, of course leaving a small minority that still exists and is very flourishing in Egypt now. Some people would say that whoever didn't accept Islam would pay the jizya, and this was coercing people into Islam. But this is not true, because if you chose to become a Muslim, you will be exempted from paying the jizya, yes, but you will be subject to pay the zakat. The zakat is not due on the Christians, but the zakat is due on the Muslims, and the zakat would usually be more than the jizya. Besides, from the jizya were exempted women and the poor and all the people and the children, etc. The zakat was something you pay because you will not be recruited in the army. Until I was, say, in university, the same was held in Egypt, not for the Christians. But if you pay, everybody should go to the army, but if you pay £20, your son will be exempted from military service. They used to call it the badaliyah, the paying instead of being recruited. And the Egyptians, of course, turned to Islam in a very massive way. And if we take it that the number of Muslim soldiers were 4,000, and when they received further support, they amounted to maximally 30,000. And now Egypt is 60 million, of which 5 million are Christians and 55 million are Muslims. It is not conceivable that the army of Amr ibn al-As bred to 60 million, whereas the inhabitants of the land could not reproduce to more than the 5 million. So it was very voluntary that the Egyptians accepted Islam. Now to move to the end of Umar ibn al-Khattab, when Persia was conquered and the majority of Persians accepted Islam, some did not, and remain in safety under the protection of the Muslim army in lieu of the jizya they paid. But we should consider that with such massive influx of people into Islam, not everybody was very scrupulous and very keen and very understanding of Islam. So many people just came in, just like joining a new system, Republican or Democrat, and you go wherever you see the way is, and it was, of course, in vogue to be a Muslim. And so not all the Persians that joined Islam had the keenness of Islam or were the deep convictions about Islam. And certainly many of them still harbored animosity to the Muslims, especially to Omar for conquering their land, etc. But they have become Muslims except with this resentment to Omar. Now a man called Al-Harmuzan, who was a little king of a province in Persia, came to Medina as a Muslim. And when he said, "I want to see the Caliph, the Khalifa," they took him and he found Omar sleeping beneath a tree. And he was very surprised. "Is this the Caliph? Is this the Emperor? Is this the King?" etc. He was used to what happened in Persia, of course. He was so surprised that the president himself is just sleeping under a tree. And he uttered a phrase that became very famous. We had it in school and children, etc. "You have been just, therefore you felt safe, therefore you could afford to sleep under a tree." And this became one of the famous sayings. But yet Al-Harmuzan had his misgivings about Islam. One night at prayer time, Omar went into the mosque to lead the prayer, when a man of Persian origin, Persian man, called Lu'lu'a. Lu'lu'a means a pearl in Arabic, but that was his name. And with him he took a knife and stabbed the Caliph 6 times. And the Caliph fell, and the man was arrested, overwhelmed by the Muslims, etc. And Omar called, "Where is Abu Ubaidah? Is Abu Ubaidah in?" And Abu Ubaidah came, and Omar ordered him to complete the prayers, leading the prayer. And he asked, "Who stabbed me?" They said, "Lu'lu'a." And he said, "Alhamdulillah, that the man who killed me is a man who never prayed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." Then Omar was preoccupied with the arranging with the future, what will happen to the government, etc., etc. So he wrestled inside himself, really, what to do, whom to name after him. "Shall I name someone?" Well, the Prophet didn't name, frankly, anyone. "Shall I do like Abu Bakr? He named me, but it is a heavy responsibility. I cannot carry to appoint someone after me." And so the best he could do was naming 6 people who were amongst the 10 people whom the Prophet gave them the news that they're going to paradise. And he called those 6 names, plus his own son, Abdullah ibn Umar, on condition that his son would not be caliph at the outset. And he told them, "You are imprisoned in this place, and after I am buried, you sit together, and in 3 days you should have elected one from amongst you." Well, that was an ordeal, but this was, I think it was a very wise thing, not monopolizing the post and putting someone there, not leaving it haphazardly, one doesn't know what would happen. But he chose the six whom he thought all the nation would have chosen one of them anyways. And he said, if you become three against three, those chose one and the other three chose one, then the casting vote would be the side on which Abu Ubaidah ibn Jarrah would be. And Abu Ubaidah from the beginning said, count me out, I don't want to be caliph. He was one of the six. But he said, I don't want to be a caliph, and let us work on it from now. Abu Ubaidah went to Ali ibn Abi Talib and said, if you are out of this, whom would you choose? And Ali said, I would have chosen Uthman ibn Affan. Then Abu Ubaidah went to Uthman ibn Affan and said, if you were out of this, whom would you have chosen? And he said, I would have chosen Ali ibn Abi Talib. So it became clear that these were the two eminent people. I would say everybody outside the room expected that it would be Ali ibn Abi Talib. But somehow, when the voting was made, they chose Uthman ibn Affan. And before his death, Omar called both of them, the two, and said, please Ali, if you are chosen, do not favor the house of Hashim, the house of the Prophet. And he called Uthman and said, please Uthman, if you are chosen, do not favor the house of Umayyah, that is the tribe of... Then Omar would say, I wish if they select that one with the bald head, not you, but Ali ibn Abi Talib. He was referring to Ali ibn Abi Talib, but he said, I couldn't have gone any further. And of course, I'm not choosing one of my own family, so this is my best. And Omar died, and Uthman ibn Affan became the third caliph of the Muslims. There will be a gap, and then we'll venture into the remaining era of Uthman and Ali. That's the sensitive part of it in 2 weeks, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Would you wait in a minute, please? Brother Ahmed will be here. Until Brother Ahmed comes, I have an announcement for bazaar sale on Sunday, the night, October 19th, from 11 to 3 here at the Islamic Center parking lot. There will be a bake sale and usable goods and all that. So keep it in your mind. October 19th, Sunday. I'd like to answer a couple of questions. Any question for Dr. Hassan?
Before you leave, look right and left and make acquaintances, and always get in the habit of doing that without even somebody drawing your attention to it. Somehow, somewhen, we have to know one another better than this. Assalamu alaikum.
Here comes Ahmed.
Assalamu alaikum. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Hassan? Yes, please. Dr. Hassan.
Come and... I am inclined against the division of voices in this hall to loud voices and subdued voices. And so the microphone is yours.
My question is, how long did Omar stay as a Khalifa? And the second, who were these six that left it to make
I think
decision?
Omar stayed about 13 years. Uh-huh. And the six people were Ali ibn Abi Talib, Uthman ibn Affan, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, the leader who won at Qadisiyah, Abdul Rahman ibn Auf, Al-Zubayr ibn al-Awwam, and Talha ibn Ubaidillah. These are the sixth people. Of course, Uthman became caliph. We'll give two lectures. Ali later became caliph. We'll give two lectures. Abdul Rahman ibn Auf, Al-Zubayr ibn al-Awwam, and Talha ibn Abdullah are two names to remember because they'll be very significant in the reign of Ali ibn Abi Talib, Al-Zubayr and Talha. And these are the sixth people. With them will be Abdullah ibn Umar, son of Umar, provided he is not one of the chosen. Want to make it difficult for you.
As Persians, they think that when Omar conquered in Persia, they say that he burned all the books. Is this true statement?
I was in the Pasadena City College participating in a conference on globalization, and it was to give the Islamic perspective, and there were several speakers, and then every speaker would be given a room. And whoever wanted to go to a speaker would go to that room, etc. And when I answered the questions about Islam, a gentleman asked me, well, you Muslims, you came to my country, I am of Persian descent, you destroyed everything, you demolished the homes, you even built houses from human skeletons. All I could tell him, well, brother, it seems our sources are very different. This didn't happen. But I know there is maybe a grudge, a nationalistic feeling. Of course, well, if it were so, and if the Persians were coerced into Islam, etc., why is Persia Muslims now and so devoutly Muslim? They could have gone out of it easily. Thank you very much.
I have go ahead.
Assalamu alaikum, Doctor Hatou, what I learned from Persians, I know their language, but I'm not Persian. They say that when Khalid ibn Walid went to fight with them, he pledged to God that I kill them. I make a river out of their blood. Khalid ibn Walid said. So one time he said that a prisoner of war is protected by his captivity. So why should a Muslim can make a pledge of God that make a flow out of their blood?
Khalid ibn Walid did not fight in Persia. Khalid did not fight in Persia at all. He had a few battles in Iraq, then he was ordered to go to Syria to help the three other armies. Number two, A captive is in protection of their captivity, and the Quran says, وَيُطْعِمُونَ الطَّعَامَ عَلَى حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا. One of the features of the mu'min is that they give food to the poor, to the orphans, and to the prisoners of war. The people who came to kill us, we should give them food. And as a matter of fact, the guards gave them the better food, and they left the lesser food to themselves. Khalid is known to have committed one or two incidents, one in Arabia and one maybe in Iraq. Incident entailing one person, killing one person. But we have to take into consideration that there is so much folklore in history serving opposing points of view. So say I hate you, I tell all kinds of bad stories about you, you hate me, you tell all sorts of bad stories about me. But certainly the Prophet and Abu Bakr etc. always emphasized, and the Khalid carried this out, no fighting unless you send it to them. Would you like to be Muslims? Would you like to keep your faith and pay a tax, or shall we fight? One has to be careful in accepting all that one reads. I came to that conclusion, really. We read many things, and God knows best, but I don't think that that this happened.
Assalamu alaikum. What are the last names of Khulafa al-Rashidin? And how come the last names change from this time to this time? Now our names are Dr. Hassan Hashoud, Hassan Lawri. How come these changes happened, including the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam?
The names of Khulafa al-Rashidun did not change. Abu Bakr was called Abu Bakr before he became Muslim, and he remained to be called that. Muhammad was called Muhammad before he became Prophet. Omar was Omar when he was a Kafir, and is Omar when he became a Muslim. And they usually related three people to their fathers. So Omar would be Omar ibn al-Khattab, Ali ibn Abi Talib, Uthman ibn means son of. Uthman ibn Affan, etc. And the names of the Khulafa were Abu Bakr ibn Abi Quhafa, Umar ibn al-Khattab, Uthman ibn Affan, Ali ibn Abi Talib. Names don't change, and it is not an Islamic requirement to change a name when you become a Muslim. It is sentimental, and maybe some people would like to mark the journey they went through from changing to non-Muslim to Muslim. It is all right, it is within your rights to change your name, but it is not a requirement, because all those names we mention here, the Khulafa, Sa'd, Khalid, Amr ibn al-As, etc., these were their names when they were Kafirs, and they kept the names after becoming Muslims.